Please join me in the serenity prayer. God, grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. Amen. Tonight, our 40-minute speaker is Tom W. from Dana Point.
I got to hook up on nitrous oxide first. It won't be a sad talk. Anyway, my name is Tom Whelan. I'm an alcoholic. I wasn't supposed to give my last name. So my name is Tom. I'm an alcoholic. Maybe I'll get it right eventually. I don't really know. I appreciate the invitation to come here and tell my dreary story. I wonder which of these two... I'm already schizophrenic, and I don't know which side I should talk to.
Right in the middle.
The big red light staring at me in the face. I don't know what that means. Anyway, I'd like to thank all the nice people that came just to hear me. I don't know what they're going to expect to hear, but anyway, I'd like to tell you about when I moved down here from West Los Angeles in 1974. This was my regular Friday night meeting. And it's been a good group ever since I've been in the program. I'm going to do, since there's a lot of newcomers here tonight, I'm going to tell a little bit about what I used to be like and what happened to me and what I'm like now. And if you can get some good out of it, fine. The main reason I do it, it sounds like I'm being a little selfish, but it's kind of true. I do it so I can remember myself what I used to be like and what happened to me. And I don't want to ever go back to that life again. And it's kind of interesting. You can look at me and say I'm old, but I'm only 47. Well, you could say I don't look it. Anyway, and I've been sober a long time. I've had a lot of experiences. And lately, in the last few years, we've had a lot of just serious problems and situations that have hit my life. My beautiful wife sitting down here in the front row, and it's just been hard. You want to, you know, enough already, you know, and you keep plodding through. But when you think about it in the perspective of what we used to be like, it really isn't all that bad, and it's all manageable and all be taken care of. Anyway, I didn't start drinking until I was in grammar school. I don't want to get in too soon. I just really enjoy, but I love to drink. I loved everything about it. I know that you're not supposed to talk that way at an AA meeting because you're supposed to talk about the evils of drink and how horrible it is. Well, I loved it. I loved every bit of it. And I'll tell you, if it could still do it, you'd have a different speaker tonight. I'll tell you that. Anyway, I did the normal things. I grew up in West Los Angeles, went to St. Paul the Apostle Grammar School, and we were talking at dinner about going to military school. Well, I screwed around so badly in grammar school, they sent me off to 3,000 miles away to New York to what I thought was like a rich man's reform school. I mean, it's the way it felt like to me. It was taught by the Christian Brothers. It was a military school, and I hated every minute of it. And I begged and pleaded to get back to Los Angeles. And I finished my last 2 years of high school at Loyola High School in Los Angeles. And my only claim to fame, because I'd started to drink when I was on a regular basis when I was living in New York. And I'm 14, 15 years old, and I kind of odd memories to have. But I remember leaving the Pennsylvania Station on weekends for the weekend. You know, I'm 14, 15 years old. And just before I start the weekend, I stop at the Savern Bar and have a few beers. And I don't think that's terribly normal for a 14 or 15-year-old kid to do. But it was very important to me. Anyway, I did that. And finally, I got back to Los Angeles and went to school here and graduated from Loyola. And I, by that time, was a daily drinker. And I was to remain a daily drinker until I came into Alcoholics Anonymous at age 32. And it was a lot of fun drinking, a lot of good times, a lot of good parties and stuff like that. My only desire in those days was to hang with my friends, four or five of us who drank the way I did. Most of us ended up in AA or dead. and just listen to jazz music and talk about philosophy and get the Cocker Spaniel drunk and all that sort of stuff. It was just fun times and all that sort of thing. And I was going over to Santa Monica City College in 1952 and 53. And I just wanted to get out of town. I didn't like what I was doing. I wanted to get away from this girl I was dating, and I just didn't like my life. And I couldn't see where drinking had anything to do with it. But I was either drunk or hungover or both. And I volunteered to be drafted, and I went in the Army right away. And I went overseas immediately. I went to Arkansas, Oklahoma, and Kentucky, which is overseas if you're a native Californian, I'll tell you that. And I continued to drink. I had the ability to type, which got a lot of guys in those days weren't typing, so I got a job at handling personnel records, and I didn't have to do any of that Army stuff. I just handled personnel records and all that. So I had a bottle in my desk drawer, and I drank all through the day, and every night we went out and got drunk, and it was just a fun time. And one particular night I was over at one of those honky-tonk places called the Jamboree Club outside of Fort Smith, Arkansas. And those kind of places, I don't think anybody in this room knows about them, but these dry states where you can't serve booze. So you bring your own bottle in and, drink out of little setups, and they give you ice and a glass and some lemons or something. And I had to drink the whole thing, waste not, want not. And so what happened is that this particular night I was really too drunk to walk, but not too drunk to drive. And so I was able to get in my car and drive back to camp. And I passed out and turned the car over 3.5 times and got myself all beat up. I was in the hospital 109 days, as I remember. And I had to make up the time, and I had to make up the money, and it was just a horrible thing. And shortly after this girl that I had run away from, she decided to come down to Fort Smith, Arkansas for the weekend for a visit. She gets off the plane and she says, "Well, now that I'm here, why don't we get married?" And I thought, well, okay, something to do, for the weekend. So we got married and signed this suicide pact for the next 20 years, and it was just, was not much fun. Two sons came out of that marriage, but I don't know what she married me for. I guess she just loved to suffer. But anyway, when I got out of the Army in 1956, not only am I married, I have these two children, but I went back to work for my dad in the electrical contracting business, which I've done since 1956 up until about almost a year ago, as I can't work anymore. But I figured drinking during the day, which I'm used to doing, I shouldn't be doing. It just didn't seem to fit in with this stereotypical idea of how I perceived myself as the manager of my dad's business and a husband and a father and all that. And so I cut it off. I just didn't drink during the day. I drank in the evenings, which is all right, and on weekends. And I didn't understand I'm an alcoholic because I don't have any role models at home. My parents didn't even drink. And so what happened is that I find myself shaky and nervous and anxious and uptight and quite accidentally, I ordered a beer with a pastrami sandwich one day. And I'll tell you, when you have a beer for lunch, it makes the afternoons much better. You new people can take that information with you tonight. Anyway, so I went and did that. And then I started having beer every day for lunch. And then it became an everyday occurrence. And then I found a drinking beer in the middle of the day made me sleepy. And I started having a couple of vodka tonics for lunch. Make them a double, if you will. And I'd be doing that. And I'm drinking and working and doing all the stuff that we do. And the alcohol turned on me. I don't know whether it happened on some Thursday afternoon, but it just seemed like about this time it turned on me, where I could drink with impunity and get drunk periodically and have a good time. And I'm drinking maybe probably a quart a day by this time. And I find myself maybe at some club in Sunset Strip. I remember this one particular night. I drank 27 Scotch and Waters and drove a whole bunch of people home. And yet, and laughing and scratching and having a great time. And next day, I may be sitting in my car alone, beating my fists on the steering wheel, wondering what's wrong with me, when my life has all gone to hell, and why is it so awful and black, and all these responsibilities and all this life that I have, it was just horrible. And so I sought the help of psychiatrists, something we all used to do in the late 50s and early 60s, and I found a doctor I had a pretty good rapport with. And I told him about my highs and my lows and my strange growing up and all the stuff that we tell our doctors. I told him everything, except one small thing. He kept asking me, how much do you drink, Tom? And I lied to him like you're supposed to. I told him 6 or 8 ounces of alcohol a day. Doctor, it seemed like a normal amount for a heavy drinker to drink it, more than had to be a heavy drinker, because it is, after all, a sign of manhood and adulthood for me to control and enjoy my drinking, my great obsession. I didn't understand that when I was controlling it, I wasn't enjoying it. And when I was enjoying it, I wasn't controlling it, but I couldn't see that in those days. And all I really wanted was to have people get off my goddamn back and leave me alone. I go to work religiously every day. I take the kids to Indian guides and the movies they want to see, bowling and the beach, any other goddamn thing they want to do, because I'm a good father. And anyway, and I really felt put upon, you know. People complain about your drinking and all that sort of stuff, and I try to keep it as low key as I possibly could. My wife couldn't understand why I would have one drink when I get home from work before dinner and be passed out on the couch after one little drink. She didn't realize I already had a quart, you know, so that's kind of like the way it was. And I sought the psychiatrist about 3 or 4 years in, out of private therapy and group therapy, the therapy you can dream up. And because I couldn't be honest with him about my number one problem, which is my alcoholism, I got sicker and sicker and sicker in this guy's care. I was doing all this kind of remodeling and all that sort of stuff, and I, on Thursday afternoons, it came down to this. I had a 4 o'clock appointment in Beverly Hills, right around the corner of my psychiatrist's office was the little club. And I went in there and I had 3 or 4 double scotches to get yourself in better shape to see your psychiatrist. And we all know we look better when we leave a bar. And look at that back bar, you have more handsome, more together. And you can relate more to the psychiatrist. You can be more honest in the whole thing. This one particular day, I walked in and I sat down. We were having our session. He looked at me and he said, "You know, you're drunk." I said, "What do you mean I'm drunk?" He said, "You look drunk, you act drunk, and you smell drunk. I assume you're drunk." I said, "Well, I had a couple of beers for lunch," which I think is our stock answer. He says, "I think it's a little bit more than that, a little bit more recent, and you're going to help me with my drinking problem, albeit my non-existing drinking problem. I'll go along with the gag, whatever." And he put me in heavy dose of Librium and heavy dose of Stelazine, which are some kind of psychotic drugs. I don't know what I was taking those for, but psychiatrist thought I needed them. Anyway, he told me, incidentally, don't drink with these drugs. What do they know? So I continued on popping these pills whenever I felt like it. And I drank. You can't just take them without drinking something, so you take it with a little scotch or a little vodka. And I was wiring these remodels in Bel Air and Brentwood and Pacific Palisades and the Valley and all the lovely areas that I worked in. And I don't know of any major electrical problems that I caused. I don't really know. I don't have any really big fires that I charged, but I said, hey, shit happens, you know. So anyway, I went on that way for quite a while. And I drive down Wilshire Boulevard, get to a little silly corner like Wilshire and Westwood. About 10 o'clock in the morning, wait for the signal to change, take about an hour and a half, and I'd come to. And some lady said I ran into her car, which I suppose I could have. I'm not your best witness. And Come home at night, and 6 or 7 o'clock, lay down the living room rug, take a little nap before dinner time. Sometimes I'd miss dinner, but there's other meals. And I'd get up and 11, 12 o'clock at night, go take a leak in the linen closet and go to bed. Just my wife was getting... My wife was losing her sense of humor over this kind of stuff, which they'll do, you know. And so she files for divorce. Miserable bitch. Here I am, you know, looking for a place to live. You're laughing at... You think this is funny. You're looking at a victim here. I am a victim. A big V on my neck or my head or whatever this is here. And I just got myself a one-room place right behind my favorite drinking bar called the Cork and Fork on Worcester Boulevard. And I had sort of a routine. Get up in the morning, 6, 7 o'clock, sit on the edge of my wet bed from perspiration or what have you, and go to the linen closet where I'm hiding the booze from myself. I guess old habits die hard. And I get my morning vodka out and have another one, another one, another one. 8 o'clock in the morning came and I had a half a pint to a pint in my stomach and I could go off and go to work and hope I would last until lunchtime where I could sit at these bars or wherever I was going. And I would have my drinks and get myself together. And it was some days I couldn't get past 10:30. I'd start to shake and the terrors would come back. And, excuse me, I'll be right back. I've just got to run down to the hardware store for something, ma'am. And lay down in the front seat of my car and drink a little hot vodka and get the motor running where I could last, get to these little bars and have my drinks and maybe get back to work, maybe just go home and watch General Hospital on television, whatever seemed like the right thing to do. And that was what my life was like in 1965. My wife came to visit me in October, and she told me what kind of a husband I was, what kind of a father I was, what kind of a son I was to my own mother and dad, and what was I going to do about Christmas was coming up, and the kids needed toys and clothes, and the attorney wants to be paid, and you turn the electricity off again, they're going to turn the phone off, and the insurance is elapsed. What she's telling me about these mundane problems, I've got my own problems. And mercifully, she left. And I just flipped out. Fortunately for me, the night before, I had just scored 100 Seconal sleeping pills, of which I took all of those and a bunch of scotch, and I just checked out. It's the understandable thing to do. Because you get to a point with your alcoholism and drug addiction where you really can't do it anymore. I know we're joking here about saying this time it'll be different. But you get to a point where you realize it's really not going to be any different. What's going to be different? You're still going to be doing this stuff. I couldn't stop drinking, nor did I want to. And I knew that I could not go on any longer living the way I was living. And so I took this overdose, and for all intents and purposes, I died that Thursday morning. A kid that was working for me part-time thought I was acting a little bizarrely. And he came to my apartment, and they somehow got the door open. I didn't leave any notes or any hysterical phone message. I just wanted to get out. I just didn't want to have to do it anymore. And he could see what happened and called the ambulance, and they shipped me up to UCLA Medical Center where they pumped me full of holes, and I was, I guess they pumped my stomach. I don't know if I wasn't there. But they, I was in a coma for 13 hours, and I came to. In this funny looking green room, and I thought, Christ, I can just screw this up. I can't even get out of here. Talk about bad breaks. And anyway, when my vital signs came around, they put me in another ambulance and they shipped me off to a mental institution where they put people like us in those days. They didn't have the facilities that that they have now to take care of people like us. And the mental institution, I guess, wasn't that far afield. And I was in there for quite a while. I had a 24-hour guard on me. I guess they were afraid I was going to do something rash. And I stayed there, and I had plenty of Thorazine to keep me very tranquil. And eventually I made my little ashtray well enough. They let me out, and first place I stopped was Jerry's Liquor Store in Olympic, and I bought a quart of vodka and a quart of scotch, because I knew that I drank everything up before I made our trip to the hospital, and so I had to stop at Jerry's and get a quart of each, and I stayed drunk that weekend, but I'm drunk every day, it didn't make any difference, and I went to work on Monday morning, and I got on the fourth rung of a ladder to change some light bulbs, which is not overly technical. And I couldn't do it. I was shaking a little bit too much, and I was unsteady, and the trauma, I think, from what I had been through was more than I could really handle. I told the lady I'll come back another day. I gave her some lame excuse, like I had the flu or something. And I checked in with another psychiatrist. This one 5 days a week. If you're wondering how I'm affording a psychiatrist 5 days a week, I'm not. My daddy's taking care of me. I can't take care of myself. I'm only 32 years old. I can't make the payments on my house. I can't take care of these kids. I can't do anything any other self-respecting 32-year-old would do. And I felt like such a failure, and that's pretty much what I was. And I spent a miserable holiday season, if you want to call it that. And I went to Mass on Christmas of 1965, and I got on my knees in the back of that church, and I asked God to grant me some peace. I don't want to quit drinking, because it wasn't an issue. But I wanted to sleep for more than 2 hours at a time. If you drink the way I drink, getting to sleep is not a major problem, because you drink all through the day and most of the evening. By 8 or 9 o'clock at night, you're pretty well passed out. That's after a couple of quarts of booze during the day. And if I did get to sleep, I'd wake up and pace that room around, have some more to drink, and walk some more, and then go back to sleep a couple of more hours and get back and do it all over again. That's what my life was like in 1965. And 2 days later, my prayer was answered, although I didn't see it as such. But I woke up one morning, nothing new had happened in my life, nothing good, new, good, or nothing bad. It was just one of those mornings. And I went to my linen closet and got my morning drink and had another one and another one and another one. 8 o'clock in the morning came, and it was... I went and put the bottle back on the top shelf, and I noticed a bottle of Ballantine Scotch had about that much left. I thought, Christ, that's a lot of scotch at 8 o'clock the night before. It was remarkable how much I was drinking, and it was no more or no less that I was drinking all the way along, but it was kind of like shown to me. And I went to the phone a few hours later, and I called Alcoholics Anonymous, of all places. And I went to a meeting that night at Ohio Street in West Los Angeles. And I sat in the back of the room where you're supposed to sit and you're new. Don't get too close and don't pick up any coffee cups or think you're a member. And I sat back there on my hands, afraid someone's going to see me shaking because I didn't have quite enough to drink. And I was purple in color. I had green slime coming out of my mouth from the breath purifiers I was chewing, so nobody knew I was drinking. And I was sitting there during the meeting, and some jerk who I was sitting next to raised my hand as a newcomer, which I think was very nice. And that after that meeting is when I walked up to the man who's to be my sponsor. I didn't know any of this at the time. I didn't know who the sponsor was. But he was the secretary of the meeting. And I said, excuse me, sir, you seem to be some sort of a big deal around here. How do you join Alcoholics Anonymous? He says, you don't drink, kid. I said, yes, I'm planning on cutting down. And he said, no, you're... What is he doing? Texting? You love that here? Makes me crazy. You wonder why people even go to a meeting and text the whole thing. I don't get it. You say sober the way you want to say it. It's fine with me. It's strange. Anyway, I don't know why I've never asked back after I talked about it. Anyway, so I... this man was able to convince me that I could go a day without a drink, that I could get out of my little room that I was living in and go to Santa Monica Beach and walk up and down that beach this cold January day. And I did that, and I shook and sweated, and I drank Karo syrup I'd heard about in those A&A meetings. I drank Cokes and Hershey bars. I probably should have died of a diabetic coma, but somehow I didn't drink all that morning or that afternoon. And when I went to the meeting that night, I was sitting in the middle of the group, and I realized it was the longest time I've been without a drink since I was a junior in high school. I thought, oh, how amazing. And I started on this journey that we're all on. And I don't know, my wife and I reconciled, and then she had some naive idea that I had some naive idea that she was going to go to Al-Anon and get the kids to go to Alateen and Al-Tot and get the dog to go to Alphabet and that other stuff, but that was not going to happen. And so eventually I got through that first few months, about 8 or 9 months, and I left that one meeting, one Friday night meeting, another meeting like very much like this meeting. And I was so depressed and so upset, I was crying and laughing maniacally and just Looney Tunes, as crazy as I've ever been or been since. And I even went down to the beach on a full moon night, tried to sort it all out, and I couldn't. And I ended up at my sponsor's house quite late that night. I got him out of bed, and he wanted to know what I was doing, and he wanted to know why I wouldn't park the car in the street with the rest of the car, because I had parked on his front lawn, which he didn't appreciate. But I had to talk to him. I had to talk to him now. I couldn't wait around for anything else. So anyway, he suggested it's time for me to go home and do a searching and fearless moral inventory of myself, which is a fourth step. And I didn't see how it applied to me. I spent most of my life in the Catholic system, examination of conscience and confession. If that's not a fourth and fifth step, what is? Years I'd spent in psychiatrist's offices talking about what I used to be like, what happened, what I'm like now. And he seemed rather bored through all of that, and he cursed me and embarrassed me, and against my better judgment, I had to go home and start this fourth step. But I was able to put in that fourth step things I was never able to tell a Catholic priest in confession, because they were too tacky, too embarrassing, too sinful, if you will. Things that I couldn't tell a psychiatrist. You can't tell them that kind of stuff. They think you're crazy. So you have to be very guarded what you tell people in that venue. But in Alcoholics Anonymous, we beg of you to be fearless and thorough from the very start. And to put all that stuff down. And put your goals down. Find out who the hell you're dealing with. So much of my life is spent in fantasy land. And really the attitude is my case is different. And I can do any goddamn thing I want to do and all that kind of stuff. And it is not really true. And I had to, through life, had to learn all that kind of stuff, mainly in Alcoholics Anonymous. Anyway, I got very, you know, active on the program, or continued being active in the program. I had a lot of commitments, and I went to meetings all the time. And everything went all that well for, I guess, for almost 8 years, just shy of 8 years. And I looked around, these two little towhead little boys were grown up pretty much. They were getting out of high school, and both of them stoned out of their minds, both of them drug addicts, alcoholics. You couldn't walk in the living room without getting contact high. And it was just crazy. And I didn't know what I was supposed to do, what I could do. And my wife at the time, she was going along with what the kids were doing. And my youngest son said our family gave a whole new meaning to dysfunctional. Anyway, my wife filed for divorce, and that's when I moved down here in January of 74. And as I was driving on the freeway, I was thinking between my will or his will. When you're around here a while, you don't want to screw this thing up. You want to do it correctly. So I said a prayer that my sponsor gave me, a sheriff of the U.S. God, I have no idea where I'm going. I do not see the road ahead of me, and I cannot know for certain where it'll end. Nor do I really know myself, and the fact that I think I'm following your will does not mean that I'm actually doing so. But I believe this. I believe the desire to please you does in fact please you. And I hope I have that desire in everything I do, and I hope I never do anything apart from that desire. And I know if I do this, you will lead me by the right road. Though I may know nothing about it at the time, I seem to be lost in the very shadow of death. I'll not be afraid, because I know you will never leave me to face my troubles all alone. Anyway, I got down to Dana Point, and got a nicer apartment with a lot less money, and I was about 3.5 minutes too late for the Yellow Pages, and so I spent a whole year with no advertising trying to start a electrical contracting business down in South Orange County, and it was difficult, back and forth to Los Angeles, and it was a trying, difficult year. 1974 was a very, very difficult year. But I got through it, as we all get through everything, anything, no matter what comes our way, we get through it. I started date again, which is never very successful. I wasn't too good at it in high school, much less when I was then 40 and 40-something. And went together, had a pretty good time, and it got too hot and heavy, and I broke it off. And then we got back together again the following summer, I think. And shortly after that, she landed in South Coast Hospital having a radical mastectomy. And I asked her where she was going to move to. And she didn't want to go here, didn't want to go there. And so I invited her to come home and stay with me. And I told her I'd take care of you until you start to feel better, which she did. And the relationship intensified. We were ultimately married. And we had a pretty good marriage, other than the fact of her cancer and my two alcoholic sons and her three daughters and a son who were not much better condition than my kids are in, because they love to come to visit us in the various stages of stoneness. Anyway, they're all alive today. Those that are still, they're all sober today. Those that are still alive is what I meant to say. It was quite an experience. My youngest son had fallen out of a second story window, stoned on angel dust and some cheap wine, and ended up in East LA Hospital. And I went to visit him. I said, "Jim, this is much to shoot for. Why don't you go to this scuzzy city? You come on down to Dana Point. I'll put you to work and get yourself an apartment." "Oh no, Dad, have too good a time up here. I can see that all cast and shackled up with all kinds of restraining stuff." He did come down, did come to work for me shortly after that, and stayed sober in front of me because he knew that I wouldn't have anybody in my business. It was loaded. And he got picked up one Saturday night for drunk walking. And when he got out of the Santa Ana jail, he realized he had to quit drinking. So he did it all on his own. Did all on Quaaludes and marijuana, which is another whole program. But we were having lunch up in Tustin one particular day. And I suggested that he come to the Wednesday night speaker meeting at one of my home groups in Laguna Beach, because our best speaker, Norm Alpe, was talking that night. And he came strictly for, I guess, entertainment value or whatever, and loved it. And got sober and stayed sober 26 years. And then I think he got kind of tired of working for me or whatever. Anyway, one particular day, he wanted to meet me for coffee. And we met, and this morning he told me that he was gay. And I thought, no, how can that be? You know, I should have known about this. And I was very disturbed, and I didn't know what the heck to do. But we worked it all out, of course, over the years. And it was just a tough thing to go through and to live through and all that sort of stuff. But as I said earlier, you can get through anything. And so finally, he went off and did other things, and he met this guy, and he and Patrick moved to Hawaii, and they set up business over there. Among other things, they fit and sold toe rings, which is every father's dream, I think, to have that particular thing. Anyway, when he was diagnosed HIV positive, They had to move back to San Francisco. They moved to San Francisco to be where the heart of all the medical stuff is going on. And he's lived, you know, fairly well with that. I guess it's been about 25 years, I think, he's had it. He's still alive. He was sober and active in San Francisco. And those of you that may know a little bit about HIV, the medications they have are just something else. And he got kind of attracted to one particular pain medicine and sleep medicine and got addicted to it and then ended up going back drinking and was picked up for common drunk in San Francisco. And this all happened about 5 years ago. It just broke my heart. I thought, oh, how can this be? You know, you keep... you hold on to little things and you think, at least he has that. Well, he blew that. And fortunately, let me see, two years ago, this coming July, I went up to San Jose to talk, and he was in the audience, and I presented him with a two-year cake. So I'm very, he's very active in San Francisco now. But to go through all that kind of stuff. And my my oldest son, sober 20, just got 28 years in the first day of December, and I'm very proud of him. And he, but about 5 years ago, about the same time, his wife, who he met on the AA campus, after two of my grandchildren, she decided she didn't want to be married anymore and had fallen in love with somebody else. And it was a big upset in our family to see all that go on. But it's part of life, and you just have to accept it and go through it and be helpful when you can. But when you have kids, you want the best for them. You don't want them to have to suffer and go through all the stuff, and you just have to keep your mouth shut and suit up and show up and just go on and do about your business. And so they're working through all of their deals now. At least I hope they have. My second wife had about 7 surgeries, constant chemotherapy, and a lot of radiation. And she passed away the day after Christmas of 1985, and I was devastated. I thought, how can this be? And then she was there, and she wasn't there. I mean, there's something wrong. And I'd done a third step on her cancer. You know, turned my life and my will over his care, and I turned over her cancer and the whole thing. She died anyway. And there's something wrong with this picture. And I was devastated when it was... 1986 was a terrible year for me. I had no joy. I went to work, did all this AA shit and all the other stuff that we do, and I just suit up and show up and go through the whole routine. And somehow I got through 1986. And I realized the third step did work. It says, my God, I offer myself to thee to build with me and do with me as thou wilt. Relieving the bondage of self, that I may better do thy will. Take away my difficulties, that victory over them may bear witness to those I would help. Thy power, thy love, thy way of life, I do thy will always. And that's the way I kind of like see myself now, in a position to help people. And I've been around a long time. I've got 45 years of sobriety, and I've had a lot of experiences, and I've just touched on a few of them this evening. And I've done them all sober, with the hope that things are going to work out fine. You just keep putting one foot in front of the other and keep going to meetings and keep helping people. And I've been, I think, a good help to a lot of people who have had similar problems with that they have had. About, I guess, 24 years ago, I saw this beautiful blonde lady get her fifth cake. She's got a 29th birthday coming up in another week. I happened to be sitting next to her sponsor. I said, who's that pretty-looking blonde? And she said, oh, that's Gloria. You ought to ask her out. You might have fun together. And so we went out for one date, and we've been married almost 23 years or 22 years. I need a calendar with all the stuff that I've been going through. Anyway, we have a wonderful life. We have, obviously, as I said at the onset of this talk, we have a lot of problems, a lot of stuff that goes on in our routine that are unexpected. And as Gloria said the other day, she said, it doesn't look like we ever have any minor problems. They're always major, major deals. But on the other hand, I think some smart-ass AAs will call it quality problems, but I guess it's kind of true. Anyway, I, about 4 years, this coming June, it'll be 4 years, and I'd worked all day long, and then Gloria and I went for dinner before our Wednesday night meeting, and came home, watched a little television, got up the next morning, and I was staggering. I was dizzy, I couldn't walk, and I just like the good old days. And I went out and got some coffee and something to eat, And then I vomited, which I don't ever do. And I go to the gym every day, or 6 days a week, and I was then too. And I figured, I'll look fine at the gym. I can't even stand up, for Christ's sake, but do any exercises. So I went to the doctor, and that night I had a four-way bypass, and I'd had some heart deals apparently, and there was no warning or anything like that. And then after that, I got out of the hospital, and the rehabilitation and all of that sort of stuff, and it was just not much fun. I had no end of people that I sponsor and friends of mine and all that kind of stuff that came and stayed with Gloria and stayed with me. And I got through all that, and then 2 years ago, this coming June, I had another episode, which I had to have four stents put in another artery, back into the hospital, and more rehabilitation and all that. I mean, it wasn't much fun to go through. I'm scared to death through the whole thing, and you just have to do the next indicated thing. And I thought that was pretty much over. But last April, Gloria and I were out to dinner, and I had these headaches for a week, and it wouldn't go away, maybe 2 weeks. And I went to the hospital the next morning, and they couldn't find what was causing the headaches. No matter what they gave me, they wouldn't go away. And that night, they found out what it was. I had a subdural hematoma, whatever that is, and I had the first of two brain surgeries, which I had to go through, and of course they told Gloria that I had less than a 50-50 chance of surviving, but anyway, off to the operating room, and it was not much fun getting over that whole thing too. Different kind of rehabilitation this time, and it was just horrible to go through, and you think, you know, enough already. And you just keep sitting up and showing up, and now, of course, I can't work anymore, and it broke my heart to think that I've been working for 50-some-odd years, and then now I just run errands and go to the gym. It's about the only active thing I do anymore, and I love giving AA talks when I'm asked, but it wore me out. I'm pretty much exhausted right now. I keep forgetting to breathe through my nose, but maybe I'll learn how to do that. I don't know. But anyway, whatever it is, no matter what comes down the pike to you in your own lives, you can get through anything like that. If you're new and you think you're going to do this by yourself, you're doing it wrong. We do this thing together. And it's a we program. And I would wish upon you what I have had, not the physical problems, but the good, comfortable life that I've had for the last 45 years. I guess the real joy of working with a lot of guys, sponsor a lot of guys. And it's just a joy to do that. And if you're new, I hope you keep coming back. And thank you very much.